This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, or streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me tonight are Richard Hawes.
Hello, everyone.
And Stephen Lockridge.
Hello.
This week, we're going to kick off with a film that kind of stars or co-stars or even cameos Mickey Rourke. Then we've got a film called Elise with a bit of Anthony Hopkins again. Then we've got a film called Safe Inside and then a bit of Asia Argento in Agony. Then we've got a fan film called It's Me, Billy. We'll talk about that later. Our short shot is a nice little film called Eighth Wonder. And then in the DTV throwback, I'm going to be talking about one of my favorite films, Blunt Force Trauma. So without further ado, let's crack on. Our first review then is Imprisoned, also known as Night Walk. An American called Frank is sent to prison by a corrupt judge for his wife's murder. His quest for justice takes into a spiritual journey led by Muslim inmates from the moderate convert to terror-linked fundamentalist. Fundamentalist. Okay, that's a kind of broad brush as to what this film is. It's a bunch of cliches is what it actually is. So we got this American guy with his girlfriend. What country does he get imprisoned in, Rich?
It doesn't say.
Well,
it's not Saudi, is it? But it's something like Saudi.
Well, I don't know,
it just says, doesn't it, at the beginning, somewhere in Arabia, and that's it.
That's a good point. Yeah, it does. Yeah,
because that was what was kind of confusing me, because I think he was supposed to be in Morocco, but then when all the guards were Americans wearing American uniforms. So I don't know if he was arrested and imprisoned originally in, say, Morocco, and then extradited and imprisoned in the US. Is that what happened?
Yes.
Right, okay.
It's weird. It's very convoluted. We've got a really rubbish piece of in media res to kick things off. We don't need it at all. It's a mess, is this film, is what it is. We got these sort of two, you know, the past and the present and the future sort of like melding together. Mickey Rourke turns up as this, kind of the head of the Aryan Nation element of sort of the prison population. It's quite amusing, actually, when he's sort of saying, you know, as long as you're not queer, as long as you're not black, you know, as long as you're not a Jew, we're fine with you. And then he starts talking about, you need to put on some muscle, mate, you know, to get a few tats on you. And I'm thinking, you did say you weren't interested in the gays, right? But anyway, I digress. So Frank's cellmate is this Muslim who sort of got caught up in a bit of extremism or something. And he ends up being, in very much the same way in American History X, you know, cellmate ends up being this sort of spiritual guide that he needs. In the meantime, shenanigans are going on outside. I really, really was bored to tears with this one, apart from a few elements. So let's go to Steve. Steve, what do you make of?
It was terrible, to be fair. Like what you're saying, the acting is absolutely piss poor. I think the only one who actually puts a decent performance in is Mickey Rourke, to be fair. Everyone else, the lead guy is terrible. His lawyer is even worse. She just screams and she's shrill and... Oh, it was awful. The editing was terrible. And like I said, the jumping round, moving from the past to the future to blah, 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 it didn't work at all. And the actual... plot didn't make sense. I still don't know why he was kind of framed or what the judge had to do with it, or it's just not explained at all in the film.
It's not explained very well. The idea is that these three sort of Arabian policemen were harassing you know, this girl,
yeah,
his wife, they shot her. So basically they shot an unarmed American citizen in the middle of this, you know, this sort of huge deal going down that Eric Roberts is sort of party to. So basically he's asked to help cover it up to make it look like, you know, the guy had killed his wife, I guess. Spoilers. But they,
yeah.
So.
But yeah, yeah, he doesn't explain it well enough to me, I don't think. And then obviously the Muslim prayer room being shut down and all that kind of stuff. It just didn't flow. It was just too... Every cliche in every prison film is basically thrown in there, really.
Mm.
You know, I was very disappointed.
I can't say I was disappointed because I didn't actually have high hopes in the first place. But anyway, Rich, have you got any positive things to say about this?
I know it is quite uneven. It does go all over the place. And the, you know, it's one of those films without, it's the white male experience again, but it's another one with he's not a strong lead. You know, he's just, he's very bland. He's not appealing. He's quite obnoxious. I know that's the journey that his character's supposed to take, but he's not an appealing character and you don't really like him very much. Fun fact, I don't know if the actor's name is Sean Stone. And I'll read to you some of his credits. Salvador, Wall Street, Born on the 4th of July, The Doors, JFK, Heaven and Earth, Natural Born Killers, Nixon, etc., etc. Who is he?
That's what I was thinking. Is it his son?
He's Oliver Stone's son, yes.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, I don't think he's a very appealing lead actor. I mean, he does direct as well, apparently, but he's mostly famous for having small appearances in his dad's movies, at least until recently. So, yeah, he didn't go on. I did like the actress playing his girlfriend. Mm-hmm. I thought she was pretty good, but everything was so melodramatic and sort of quite trite. I guess, I don't know, is the best way to put it. And then the film is kind of livened up with these, you know, B-movie icons and familiar faces just sort of turning up randomly. Mm. I mean, there's Mickey Rourke, obviously, but we've also, I mean, the best person in the movie, I think, is Patrick Kilpatrick as the guard. Mm. He's you know, he's done prison movies going back to, you know, Death Warrant, where he was the Sandman and stuff, and he's he's done lots of bad guy roles and whatever. He's a very good character, or more of a character actor than sort of just your general villain. So I thought he was good. He was selling it.
He reminded me of I forgot the name of the actor now. The guy was in The Expendables. He used to be MMA.
What, Randy Couture?
Randy Couture.
They do have a similar look.
Yeah, I thought it was him to begin with.
He's played a lot of these sort of prison guard and everything. Even he did a British movie called Borstal, where he was the head of a Borstal and stuff randomly, even though he was American. But anyway, and so I enjoy him and his role. But then there was other people turning up, and you've already mentioned Eric Roberts. I mean, I was watching one bit, and there's a montage, and suddenly there's a blink and you'll miss it shot of Eric Roberts, and I'm like, is that the briefest scene of Eric Roberts in one of these movies? But no, it's a holdover because then he's going to appear at the end of the movie. He's on the American version of the poster and stuff. Yeah. So he does have a scene, but it is a typical day player kind of scene for Eric Roberts. They just hold it to the end. And but other people turn up, like Richard Tyson and Louis Mandelor, and I can't remember. I think there's one or two others in there. But
Richard Tyson was playing his friend, wasn't he? The journalist.
The journalist, yeah.
Richard Tyson was playing one of the other guards who Patrick Kilpatrick's character is having a chat with and they're talking about something or other in the break room. You know, it's an inconsequential scene, but I was like, oh, it's Richard Tyson. It's just like it's like one of those Russian films or whatever we've seen where they just grab loads of people. You know, this is the kind of thing you would expect Michael Madsen would just suddenly turn up in a scene. Yeah.
It's a Diamond Cartel fifth execution.
Exactly. Okay. Second. I mean, even on IMDb actually lists Tiny Lister, who died, you know, died recently. He's listed in the credits. I don't remember seeing him in the movie, he's on the list. But yeah, Sarah Alami played Sarah, the girlfriend who gets killed, during the titular Night Walk. Obviously, the UK title has been changed to Imprisoned, and it's just weird. There were bits of it I liked, but it was more it's cheap. The prison didn't look like a prison, and stuff. It just looked like a plain room sort of painted blue or something. I don't know. It had no atmosphere of that kind of prison environment. Some of the scenes shot on the location in Morocco look quite nice and stuff. And obviously there's the French Algerian guy who's his cellmate. He gets a couple of nice scenes and stuff, but I agree with Mike really that it is a bit of a mess. It's less than the sum of its parts, I would say.
There are a few moments where I perked up, but for the most part it's cliche after cliche basically. The most interesting part was when we get a flashback to the prison guard when he was doing a tour of duty in Afghanistan, how he got his injury, which is incredibly random in itself. This guy suddenly gets this sort of little sort of action scene in the middle of the film. It's very, very strange.
Yeah, so it was. But why? Why do they incorporate that? It's just weird. The structure of the movie. I mean, it starts out and you think, oh, it's in media res, and that's then, oh, well, no, it's actually flashbacks, and then suddenly we just keep. They keep just going on the flashbacks route to fill out the backstory of how they actually. And now, what I quite like was that they didn't do massive signposts of, you know, saying present day or, you know, 3 years ago and all that, because some films do that. In this case, it was kind of treating the audience intelligently and said, you can tell he's not in the prison anymore. He's in a restaurant. Obviously, we've gone back in time. So that wasn't quite, you know, the reason. There were bits that worked, you know, the main problem is that lead actor, that lead character, I think is the main problem.
Yeah.
All right. But scores on the book one.
Sorry, mate. The flashback, you know, when he gets injured in Iraq or whatever, used to explain his racism towards all the Muslim prisoners and stuff like that. And the warden as well. That warden just popping up. He was annoying as well. He didn't make any sense because he was just like a wet fish. He was just weird.
The Lewis Mandelor character. But that's another example of cameo for cameo's sake. You know, they just thought, oh, we can get Lewis Mandelor for a day and it'll be a name on the credits.
Oh, I get that. But his character just didn't make sense. You know, like your lead guard is running the prison rather than the warden. And then, you know, he's getting his... He's being run by Mickey Rourke and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, because he's like a drug addict or something.
Yeah, he's using the drugs for the pain relief for his knees, and where he's been injured and stuff like that. And it was just infuriating, to be honest. Yeah. It really was.
So it's a damning indictment against the American Medicare system, and especially how they treat their veterans. You know, the fact that a veteran is having to turn to a scummy prison drug dealer, you know, to ease his pain, you know, shame on you, America.
Well, let's just mention Mickey Rourke for us. Let's go back to it. So Mickey Rourke doesn't have many scenes in this, does he? So he kind of appears, they kind of do the big bad introduction, and then he like turns up for a couple of scenes where he kind of just gets to be Mickey Rourke, but, you know, like a really nasty version of himself, but still got sort of walk around with his shirt open and with the jewelry and whatnot. And not looking well. I mean, man, I like to see Mickey Rourke, but it is kind of a tragedy every time I see him. You just think he looks really, really bad these days.
Well, you know, we're going to talk about him later on in the program as well in the episode. in the throwbacks, and there is a real sort of contrast in his appearance.
Yeah.
Between those two films. But yeah, absolutely.
And it's not all age.
No, it's not.
One last thing I want to mention is that on the UK release artwork, there's quotes from this creature feature corner, and they say quite an obvious quote, which is just brutality behind bars. But then there's another one saying inspired by Escape Plan and Prison Break. That doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. Just saying that you could say the producers wanted to make a prison film because they were inspired by the success of Escape Plan and Prison Break. But in no other way is the film, apart from the fact that it's about someone in prison and there is an escape, could it in any way be related to Escape Plan or Prison Break?
Can it technically be called an escape, though? Because the guy literally just walks out of prison.
That's true. It is one of the lamest prison escape sequences since Today You Die with Steven Seagal, where they basically just land a helicopter and he jumps in and they just go.
Anyway, okay, scores on the doors for what's this one called? Nightwalk.
Imprisoned.
The American. Sorry, let's do it again. Anyway, scores on the doors for Imprisoned. I'm giving this a 5 out of 10.
I'll go a 6. I mean, I did like, I liked Patrick Kilpatrick and some of the, you know, nice little cameo bit moments and bits and bobs, but yeah, 6.
Cool. Okay, 2 5s and a 6 for Imprisoned. Our next review is Elise, Memory and Hallucination intertwined to expose a history of trauma, revealing Elise is catatonic and institutionalized in a state hospital. Okay, so this is very much an art house drama. Very much an art house drama. You know, right from the opening shot, Rich.
Right from the meandering black and white. Pretentious opening.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. So we've got voiceover, we've got fake black and white because they've got a colorized element of the the kid's bike. They want us to to be aware of the kid's bike in the corner.
Paging Mr. Spielberg
from
Schindler's List.
So yes, we get this story of this woman called Elise who's having a torrid time dealing with her own sort of inner demons. Her husband, his sort of childish tantrums, her overbearing mother, the daughter of their maid who may or may not have designs on her husband and works with him. And then, you know, the maid who's looking after her son for her. So you've got all this going on, all these stupid little scenes, basically. Anthony Hopkins turns up as a psychiatrist who she goes to see. But wait, all of this is total bullshit because actually she's in a catatonic state in this hospital. And everything we're watching is actually just her sort of cognitive abilities trying to deal with things she's catching, you know, on the periphery of her understanding. I'll leave it there for a moment and hand over to Rich.
Yeah, I didn't quite catch that it was moving from that was what it was, because I was so exasperated with it for the first part, and then it basically becomes sort of passively watching it, and I thought, okay, time has moved on and we've moved on from that part of the story and now we're now in the other one. So I never really connected. It was like, oh, all of that we were watching in the black and white was what was experienced while she was unconscious. So I didn't connect that.
Yeah.
What I did find relief from at that point was the fact that the lead character wasn't talking anymore or doing anything because she was so insufferable. She is catatonic, so she's not saying anything or moving very much from that what was it, about 50 minutes in when it changes to color, and she's just in the hospital, and it becomes a completely different film experience from that point, a bit more conventional. Now, this is directed by, it's the first film directed by Stella Hopkins.
Oh, no. It's just nepotism again, is it?
So this is... So we've gone from a film starring Oliver Stone's son to a film directed by Anthony Hopkins' wife. And ergo, that is why Anthony Hopkins is here. And he's the big selling point, you know, in the cast. There's he turns up at the half hour point for a 10-minute scene. Mm. Where he's a psychologist or psychiatrist with Elise. And then he turns up again later in the hospital. But he kind of excuses himself quite often. But he's quite interesting because his character is... he's got his own views and stuff. So he's kind of... He's not towing the sort of textbook kind of line. He kind of has it. He seems a bit of a boisterous sort of put his own spin on it kind of character, which I found quite interesting. But for the most part, he's not around. It's more about her and her family. And we have to put up with weird scenes of her, say, at the start of the film, just literally wandering. She doesn't work or anything. She doesn't have anything in her life, really. She's completely disconnected from her from her family life. She goes to see a child at one point who's with the nanny, and it's like, why aren't you looking after your child? You know, she's just not there. But it's all to do with depression and stuff like that, which I've got some personal experience of living with, you know, someone with that going on. So I can kind of see where they're coming from with it. But at the same time, I did find it quite insufferable. And the latter part of the film, which does follow a more conventional recuperation thread, I guess you could say, it was much more easy to digest. But I didn't like the film at all, really, to be honest.
There's a scene, I suppose, about three quarters of the way through, when she's sort of she's recuperating, she's making progress. And then her husband comes and visits and throws a tantrum. And I was watching that, I'm thinking, what a cunt. You know, that scene is just, I've never hated someone quite so much on screen for quite a long time, but he just took the biscuit. It was really a case of like, what about me? You know?
Oh, that's where she's with the nurse.
Yeah.
And he starts getting all jealous because she's walking around with the dust.
Fucking ridiculous! Is the I just thought you absolutely. And then so later on, Anthony Hopkins sort of like very passive aggressively is going, yes, well, she was making good progress, and then she suddenly had a relapse. I wonder why. So looking at him, yeah, quite amusing.
That's what I mean. That's those little things that are going on with his character. But yes, that's the thing though. The characters in this movie are not likable. None of them are really likable at all. Yeah. It's like the worst sort of. And I don't know. It's really indulgent, is what I would say. I mean, its aspirations might be in the right place in terms of trying to raise awareness of mental health issues and that, but it didn't do anything for me.
No, probably as little for me, to be quite honest. I'm sure this has an audience somewhere, but as sort of genre enthusiasts such as ourselves, this isn't our in our wheelhouse at all, I don't think.
Did you ever see Slipstream, which was Anthony Hopkins' directorial debut, which she was producing and acting in.
Of a different Slipstream. See, this is what I'm talking about. This is what I'm talking about, Rich. We're genre enthusiasts. You mentioned something like Slipstream, and I automatically go to Mark Hamill and Bill Paxton. You know,
yeah. I go to Vinnie Jones and Sean Astin.
Okay, fair enough. But there you go. We have to score this, Rich. What are you going to give it?
3. It feels like I'm being generous. 3, maybe. 3?
Okay.
There's some nice photography, although to me, the black and white stuff doesn't look like they've made any effort with it. It does feel like they shot it in colour and literally turned it down.
Yeah. Apparently, I read on IMDb that if you watch the trailer, all the scenes you see in black and white are actually in colour.
That's interesting.
So that's exactly what happened.
Right.
As I'll find out when I put the trailer into the footnotes when this episode goes out. But yeah, no, this doesn't work for me. Didn't work for you. I'm giving this a 4 out of 10. I think that's not the lowest score, but yeah.
That's quite generous of you, I think.
It's just not our cup of tea, is what we're saying, isn't it, at the end of the day.
If you want to see a film with a little bit of Anthony Hopkins, watch The Virtuoso. That's what I say.
That's true, yeah. Although his character in that is actually horrific. Anyway, so a 3 and a 4 for Elise. Our next review is Safe Inside. Young American lovers Tom and Anna, traveling through Europe, find work at the estate of otherworldly Richard. Remote and cut off, they soon realize they need to escape Richard's powerful and controlling mind. Before we continue, guys, I just want to read the synopsis, which is on IMDb. And it is this. A thriller about the power of the human brain and love.
All in caps.
All in caps, yeah. I was trying to revoke a sort of like Patton Oswalt approach. But there you go. Okay, so we've got this couple on a bus. The guy's driving and texting in the rain along a sort of windy country road. And it crashes. So this couple get off. They're heading to this villa, this sort of farm estate or whatever. And you know, they're gonna be working as sort of labourers during the summer or whatever it is. The guy sort of running the place, this guy called Richard, he's got these dogs, and there's a bit of a sort of weird atmosphere, but you know, they're happy to be there to begin with. So the funny thing is, I don't want to sort of do too many spoilers, but having watched Elise and then watching this and watching that bit with the bus at the beginning, I thought, yeah, I know exactly what's happened. Yeah, it's so fucking obvious right from the start.
And having seen so many films before that have used that device.
Exactly. Yeah. It's all that sort of stuff going on. So let's chuck this to Rich to begin with.
Yeah, well, I did like it. I think that's interesting. It does the same. It's the same kind of... there's a couple and there's a third person who comes in, sort of upsets the balance or whatever. We've talked about it. I mean, not just lovers and you know, couples. We've also seen films where it's been mother and daughter and all that sort of thing. So but usually it's the it's like the cuckoo in the nest thing. The one cup from the outside comes inside. In this case, they're the ones going to him. So that's probably one of the more original bits of it. I mean, I don't think any of it's original, but you know, the fact that they go to there is probably a bit more unexpected than. Well, actually, no, it isn't, because I guess in another way, it's just like a typical horror film, or even like Rocky Horror Picture Show or something, isn't it? Yeah, it's just the couple turn up at the house. Yeah. So yeah, no, I'm actually going to wipe out anything I just said there, because there's nothing. There's literally nothing original going on here or whatever. I'm talking myself out of it. The whole setup is quite obvious of what's going to happen. The one thing that I thought was surprising was that the twist, which would usually be at the end, is in the middle.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of a psycho kind of change up. And it's the same, what they, like we said with Elise, you know, there's a midpoint change. So yeah, they do that with this. That was
interesting, because it then becomes a bit more of a sort of a medical investigative procedural as well. You know, there's that sort of element sort of coming.
Yeah, I mean, they both in both films we end up in a hospital in these things, and it's all like a psychological. So it's hard to say too much without going into spoilers. But there's some bits in there, like, you know, when they go into the library.
Yeah, I like that.
And there's books without words, and the records don't play properly and stuff. I thought that was really nice, and it did kind of, that was a nice little hint that sort of jogs me towards what was going on, which I thought might be happening. And And then it's kind of, you don't have to wait until the end for any of that to be reinforced. They do at least try to do something a bit different. And that's quite, but again, we've, I don't know, it's hard to say, I don't know, I'm going to have to do a spoiler warning and just sort of say, look, you know, it's things like, if you've seen anything with dreams, you know, whether it's, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street or Inception, or like Identity, the film with John Cusack and that years ago, there's really nothing in here that you haven't seen before. But I did quite like it. I like the lead actress. I mean, the boyfriend character is awful. And we're supposed to be on his side in the second part of the movie, basically. But, he, you know, he kind of becomes, he's got to try and rescue his girlfriend, basically. But he's not appealing at all. And Stephen Brand, who was the villain in The Scorpion King, and we've seen him in that Children of the not Children of the Corner, Hellraiser sequel recently. So they've cast him as a Frenchman, but he can't hold the accent. So he keeps just turning English, which was I don't know if that was intentional, whether it was a mistake, because I don't know. Yeah, without trying to spoil it too much, whether there is any artificialness to his character, but I don't think there is. I think he is supposed to be a Frenchman. It's a Polish film, or Polish co-production with Luxembourg. Director's Polish. There's a familiar, or an actress called Joanna Kulig, who I'm familiar with. She has a small role in it as a nurse. I was hoping she was going to do a bit more. But apart from that, it feels like your typical American style horror suspense kind of thriller. It's fine. You know, it's not too arty. It does have artistic leanings, some, you know, like the lavender fields and stuff. But I actually thought it was fine. And it ends, I don't know, they must have got the budget from somewhere to add this on, but it ends with a really sort of upbeat or you know, poppy song by Sia, which was quite unexpected. It just sort of changed the tone right at the end of the movie. It was the same song that was apparently used at the end of The Shallows on the end credits of that film as well. It's from like one of her older albums, from like 2015 or something. But I like that song, so I ended the film on you know, quite an upbeat note. So I've got nothing against it. It's just there isn't an original idea in here, unfortunately.
Indeed, Steve.
Yeah, I agree with Rich. It's not original. I mean, like you say, if you've seen stuff like even The Sixth Sense, in a way. You know, that kind of stuff. But I thought she was great. Even Stephen Brand, I thought he was good. Like you said, the accent just comes and goes all the time. But he's quite charming, but quite creepy in there as well. And how it's explained at the end was a little bit ropey to me. But my big issue was boyfriend, because he was just an absolute cock all the way through.
For no reason whatsoever.
He gets there. This guy's putting him up. He's going to pay him a decent wage as well, from what he said. And, you know, he's eating his food. And he's just acting like an absolute prick. And then when the twist does come, and it, you know, you get into the second half where he's kind of supposed to be the main protagonist or the hero, even then he's just an absolute ass. You know,
what do you think of his solution to solve the mystery?
Well, yeah, again, I mean, it's like,
I'm pretty sure there were less sort of extreme measures he could have taken.
Yeah, it's just so everything he does is so drastic or over dramatic in every single way, shape, form, even just speaking to people. He goes over the top and just like starts chewing him out, and that's what lost me on it. His actual character, because
like you're thinking, why is she even with this guy? I mean,
yeah, exactly.
You mean that does kind of put you on Stephen Brand's character's side, because you're like, well, he seems much more calm and reasonable, and you know, you just don't understand their relationship. The you know, him and her. Why did he even go with her on this trip? He obviously doesn't want to be there.
Yeah, you know, he might be a bit older, he might be creepy, but damn, love, you know, he's, at least he's going to talk to you nicely. Yeah. He's not going to call you cunt every 5 minutes or whatever. Mm. Or genuine.
Especially, you know, you say, you know, he didn't even want to be there sort of thing. I mean, you know, considering what we learn about him later on and how much he you know, what the stakes against him for going on that trip in the first place, is think, why?
Yeah, you want to keep a low profile, you know. Yeah. But
the bit that made me laugh in this, there's a scene where he's with you know, his girlfriend who's in the hospital, and she starts moaning, and then the guy in the bed next to her starts moaning as well.
Yeah,
and he puts two and two together and realizes what's happening. Although that was pretty horrible. It's like walking in on somebody. Yeah, it was quite amusing. I didn't particularly get on with this one. I liked some of the elements. You know, I like the little clues, as you said, that, you know, the books with the blank pages.
Mm. You like the dogs?
The dogs as well, of course. Some of the sound effects are quite good as well, you know, especially with the dogs.
I can't fault the production. I mean, the whole film looks really good. You know, the everything they've done in terms of the technical aspects of it are all, you know, perfectly fine. You know, it's arty, but it's mainstream. It's kind of stuck between those two, but it's definitely more mainstream, I would say. This, you know, in terms of comparing it to like Elise, which is really, not a film that you can approach and engage with very easily. I think this is kind of, you know, this would be very comfortable on, you know, sitting on Sky or whatever, that people would actually sit and watch it, and you know, the Blumhouse crowd or whatever might, you know, get on with it just fine. But it's just too tired, I think. You know, you'd expect a bit more creativity, I guess, in some of it.
And then you got that sort of weird motif at the end as well, when that sort of message comes up saying, "Oh, 30,000 people are in a coma at the right now," or something as well.
That was a bit strange.
That was weird. I mean, it's again, that sort of echoes what they were doing with Elise. It's kind of, I think Elise comes up with something at the end saying, "This is about this is about mental illness and whatever," and this one's trying to do something else, but about comas, which just sort of seems quite random.
Yeah,
I mean, we've seen coma films before. You know, I think it was like Trauma with Mina Suvari. Was that a coma one? I can't remember. But there's, this is territory that's been explored. You know, this kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Before, but I think maybe better, maybe worse. Can't say, but definitely the sort of dream space and all that kind of thing. Mm. We've seen much, much better versions of this kind of thing. So it's fine. It's fine.
Yeah.
Scores on the doors, then, guys. Steve, what do you reckon?
6.
Okay. Rich?
Yeah, I'm going to give it an it's fine 6.
I'm dipping down to a 5. So two sixes and a 5 for Safe Inside. Go check it out. Okie doke. Agony, the Executrix.
Executrix. I think that's what they actually say in the movie, don't they?
Right.
She's an executrix. I've never even heard that term before. No. I thought it was saying Zula Dominatrix or something. An executor of an estate, yeah.
Right, okay. What's it called?
Hello.
Agony. You saw this, Steve?
Hello.
You're all right, Steve.
Steve, we've lost your audio, I think.
I can hear a dog.
That's me. Okay. Steve.
Is Steve gone?
Can you hear us? What the hell's that? I'm typing in the dark. Oh, right. He's trying to come back in. There you go. Steve, can you hear us, mate?
Yeah, come back now. Just awesome. Cut off then for some reason.
Yeah, weird.
Sorry, lads.
Okay. That's all right. Agony. All right, let's have a look. Okay, in five. Our next review is Agony. A discontented New York family woman called unexpectedly to Tuscany to execute her estranged mother's will. There she deciphers visions of her forgotten childhood and confronts a spectral lady in red whose dark secret unlocks a terrifying destiny. Okay, so this stars Asia Argento. Finds out that her mother, who she thought had died when she was just a child, had actually just died the other week, and her existence had been kept from her by her dad and other people. And then goes to this estate in Tuscany, which she's now inherited with her family, and weird shenanigans start to happen. So, Rich, over to you.
So we saw a while ago, we were talking about Elise, which was directed by Anthony Hopkins's wife, and so therefore, you know, and Anthony Hopkins appeared in it. In this case, we've got a film directed by Asia Argento's ex-husband she's appearing in, which is quite interesting. They're obviously on good terms. She's actually the lead in this one. She's not just like a quick cameo or something. And I think in terms of that kind of you know, that's kind of horror sort of inflected story of, you know, going home again, and, you know, strange things are happening there, and it's all a bit Wicker Man and, you know, all that, you know, little bits like that. I think it's fine. It's got some quite nice, it's an Italian film. Mm-hmm. It's got some nice locations. It's all obviously rural. Asia Argento, I can remember which best to pronounce her name. She never seems to age. She still looks very youthful. I mean, obviously it was like 20 years ago she was in XXX, and prior to that, obviously she was in her father's films, stuff like Trauma. Mm-hmm. When she was a teenager. So she's been around for a long time. She's got this very distinct look, and because she's got all those tattoos and stuff that have hung around, and they haven't tried to hide them or anything, the character she's playing just has that interesting that, you know, she's got a more interesting dimension to her, because you can tell she's an edgier character, even though she's kind of got this much more, you know, this stable, you know, family life now. There's that wild child sort of thing is still sort of hanging around, and yeah, so she's quite a good lead. She's an appealing lead. The character's interesting. The stuff, but all you know, all the stuff that's happening is the kind of, again, it's a lot of stuff we have seen before, and it's fine. It's perfectly serviceable, but it's not showing us anything different. So I enjoyed it, but you know, where's the creativity?
What was a bit strange for me is, you know, I kind of. You know, I did like the atmosphere of this. You know, it was very atmospheric. Not a particular lot really happens. And I think everything that happens in the film, you know, when it's sort of weird conclusion, could easily have been avoided. It could, you know, everything that happens in the film, so well, it didn't have to happen at all. You could, you know, there's so many signposts where you could have like headed in a different direction, but you know, there was certain people sort of obviously wanted this to happen, or something was going on, but I just at the end of it I'm thinking it just felt so contrived. It's like, you know, you followed a particular set of directions when there were clear paths which could have ended it.
Yeah, and that's the same for the way the director and, you know, the writing director or whatever have led us, the audience. Mm. You know, they're taking us down a path we've been a million times before. You know, we know what is likely to befall this character before we get there. There's no sort of, I mean, with with the previous films we've talked about, there are some nice twists that come in at unexpected points. I think with this film, it's very conventional, but almost to a fault, because there isn't a real, you know, surprising or rather unexpected element at any point.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Not that I didn't like it. I mean, it's called Agony. I was not in agony when I was watching it. I think I don't know if the title Agony is really appropriate. I mean, it's certainly not a very marketable title. It's not going to catch anybody's attention. I mean, it kind of conjures a more horrific experience than you're really going to get, is what I would say. It's not a painful film to watch. It's a very conventional film to watch. I don't know, I haven't obviously been to the cinema to see the new Conjuring film or anything like that, but you know, it's the kind of film that would play comfortably to a crowd, you know, looking for like a little creepy movie to watch, you know. And it's all it's Italian, but it's shot in English, I think, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it's not an unapproachable film in any sense. It's fine. Again, it's the same kind of way I felt about Safe Inside, really.
I did like this one a bit more. I especially like the soundtrack for this one. Actually, it was quite atmospheric.
Mm-hmm.
Steve, what are your thoughts on Agony?
Again, I thought it was a bit bland, to be honest. I mean, you know exactly what's happening. You know what's coming. It's your typical, you know, we'll go back and sort stuff out, and then it all goes to shit a bit. But I just didn't think it was very scary. There's a couple scenes that are quite atmospheric. One thing I did kind of like was when you see the vision that she's seeing or whatever, it goes quite a neon colour.
Yeah.
So it kind of reminded me of, you know, a bit jolly old, you know, that kind of old school, like Suspiria type of vibe in there. But the rest of it's quite subdued and quite bland, really. Mm-hmm. So it's just them little bits that gave it that, you know, just a little bit of extra oomph to it, just give that little bit of something different. But again, it's nothing we haven't seen before. AJ Gender, I thought was very good. The husband, though, again, he was quite annoying.
Yeah.
And the kid as well. He was just a bit of a wet lettuce, really. Just...
There's a theme of husbands and boyfriends in this episode.
Crap. Yeah, he didn't really do anything. He just stood there and moaned that she was drinking. I mean, that was it, you know, and it just...
Yeah, so very passive aggressive, wasn't it?
It just didn't really go anywhere with it. Mm-hmm. And, the, you know, the end you can see coming a mile off, and, you know, it's like, you know, the locals are conspiring, and again, it just felt a bit flat to me, especially in the middle.
Yeah,
very, very flat.
We had a short cameo from Franco Nero.
He's in a few scenes, actually, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's her father, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
Did he play the father?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was the father. So. Okay. Carlo.
Maybe I wasn't paying attention at the beginning. Anyway, it's okay. Of the films we've watched so far, this one, it sort of just about comes to the top. So I'm giving this one a 6 out of 10.
Yeah, I'll probably go 6, to be fair. Yeah.
I think I'll go a 7 on this one. Wow. I did like it. I think I probably liked it just a bit more than Safe Inside, I'd say.
Yeah. I think the general consensus is of the three films we've reviewed so far. So three films?
Yeah. Four films.
Four. So far.
Yep, this is the fourth.
Yeah, it is.
One, two, three. So the general consensus...
Keep up, Mike.
Well, this I think that says a lot, doesn't it? Of the four films we've reviewed so far tonight, this is the one that we would all choose over the rest. But even, you know, it's slim pickings.
There's not much in it, I'd say. There's not a huge amount in it.
Anyway, so I believe that's 2 6s and a 7 for Agony. Go check it out. Our next review is It's Me, Billy, a fan sequel to the original Black Christmas. In this one, it's set 50 years after the events of the first movie and follows the granddaughter of Jess Bradford, the only survivor of the sorority house massacre, as she tries to reconnect with the occurrences from back when, with her two friends visiting the old sorority house itself. Let's go with Steve to begin with.
I enjoyed this. I must admit, I've not seen Black Christmas or the remake. So I was going into this quite fresh. Didn't really kind of picked up where it was coming from, but wasn't 100% sure, especially with like the Billy character. Mm-hmm. And whether he was the original slasher or whatever, I wasn't too sure on that. But on its own, I thought it worked quite well. Decently shot, decently acted, and moved at quite a decent pace. Yeah, but again, another little bit of a twist ending, but you know, could see it coming. Mm-hmm. But yeah, all in all, I enjoyed this one. It was good.
It's interesting, and it's shocking to me that the original Black Christmas is indeed sort of about 50 years old. I watched it last year for the first time as one of the films I was catching up on from, you know, films that I'd never seen before, basically. Sort of filling in. Had Margot Kidder in it as one of the sort of sorority sisters. It was very good. And it does.
Olivia Hussey was the surviving character.
Yeah.
Jess.
And it does end with them, you know, catching a killer, but not realizing that it's actually not the killer. And the audience knows because there's a voiceover or another telephone call at the end, you know, over the credits. And it is the same sort of voice, you know, it might even be the same guy, I think they got.
Well, for this one, it's I think it's the director of the film, Dave McRae, is doing the voice.
Yeah, one of the directors.
One of the directors. Yeah.
So it does follow that sort of thing, you know, this sort of creepy sort of nursery rhymes and all the rest of it in the original as well. I really like this.
So is it the same? Because this was something I wasn't quite sure about. Because is it the same location, or is it supposed to be the same location as the sorority house? Because that was what I thought it was. And then they kind of was like, oh, she bought this house and she moved up here and all that stuff to get away from everything. So I was a bit confused.
I got the impression it was the house next door.
Uh-huh.
And they couldn't actually get into the sorority house itself because they knew who she was.
Right, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, she'll say that in the car at the beginning. Yeah.
So Rich, over to you, mate.
Well, I don't have Black Christmas very fresh in my mind, so I'm a bit lost in terms of some of the threads, like you say, in terms of like the location and stuff, because I was thinking, how did Billy end up being in this house? You know, does that make any kind of sense? You know, has it been living there for years and whatever?
Well, I think we know now, don't we?
Yeah, but if it is the same location, then yes, that does make sense. But if it wasn't, then I was a bit confused. So you cannot fault the production values on this. Really good. We talked about another film in a similar vein, which was Voorhees. Well, not Voorhees, but also Never Hike in the Snow and Never Hike Alone, the film that preceded it. A very similar kind of budget level and quality level in terms of the polish on the film, clearly made by professionals. The guy, Dave McRae, who's done this one, has done loads of stuff before, loads of fan films, lots and lots of Halloween stuff. I haven't actually had a chance to watch any of it, but having seen this, I presume that it's, you know, At least some of the more recent stuff must be to quite a high standard. You probably start. I think if you went back and watched his older films, you would probably see an interesting progression in terms of, you know, sort of quite amateurish fan film to quite polished. Because I've watched like a trailer for Halloween the Night He Came Back. That looked quite smart. But yeah, so this is the first film I've seen from him, Dave McRae, and not being. I watched the Black Christmas remake, the second remake. I mean, the first remake from the 2000s, I thought was fine. The new one, which featured Cary Elwes and Imogen Poots, I think, which wasn't really Black Christmas at all, in my view, completely different in numerous ways, and just didn't feel like a very well made, you know, in terms of the scale or something. This felt really, this was. Well above its shooting above, you know, whatever the expression is, above its weight or something.
Yeah.
So I really liked it. You know, they've taken a striking location, a small cast, you know, lots of atmosphere, throw in the references and stuff, and it all just works really nicely. Now it's it is classifiable as a feature, but it's only 42 minutes, so it's. It goes along quite briskly. There's plenty of room for more story to be. You know, there could be a second part of this that you could then potentially put together as one full, what we would consider a full length feature of like 90 minutes. So it'd be interesting to see where, if anywhere, they choose to go with taking. I mean, there isn't a full conclusion. It's you know, like many horror movies. It's but like the original Black Christmas. You know, there's a twist ending for us and stuff. So yeah, I highly recommend it. Free on YouTube, you know, 42 minutes, you know.
Yep.
There's much worse things to be doing.
We'll put the link in the footnotes as we usually do with the shorts. This is available on YouTube, as Rich said. Scores on the doors then. So this definitely gets, I'm gonna give it a high 7. So Steve?
Yep, 7, definitely. Definitely the best thing we watched this week.
Yeah.
I'm going to give it an 8.
2 7s and an 8. Now we're talking. They're finally something to get us out of the lower figures. Yes, 2 7s and an 8 for It's Me, Billy.
Billy, but the guy who does the voice, the director, by the way, is Fireman Sam in America, apparently.
The American version.
He's the American Fireman Sam, apparently. I mean, at least he's got a few credits of where he's played Fireman Sam. So.
Okay. So, yeah, we'll put the footnotes. We'll put the footnotes. We'll put the
link. No, sorry, you didn't play Fireman Sam. Sorry, he was a supporting character in Fireman Sam. I apologize.
Oh, boy. We'll put the link in the footnotes. Go check it out. Our short shot this week is Eighth Wonder. When a strange creature is spotted floating through the skies, it sparks chaos and treasure hunters alike. A young woman finds herself having to defend against a team of bounty hunters, but what is the prize? This is a nice little 8-minute short, roughly 8 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Incredibly well shot. A really good fight scene in the middle of this. The camera work in particular is superb. And the sound effects that they use really, really help sort of bring this all together. I really, 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 really like this. Rich?
Yeah, I first came... this is from JKK Films and a director called Ayman Samat. And I first came across... this director with a little sort of spoof trailer that they'd done with Godzilla versus Kong, which the video basically was called I Put My Cat Wayne in the Godzilla versus Kong trailer. And it ends up with Godzilla versus Kong versus Wayne. And it's just really, really fun, really, really clever. And he's also done other things like Justice League, but my cat is Batman and different things like that. And that's when I discovered that they'd made these short films and stuff as well. And this is his most recent, but I had seen a couple of the older ones. But so this one came in, and I've not seen all of his films before. I've seen a couple, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But it feels it's still I've it can do action really well, and it is an action short, but there's more to it. The world around it is bigger. It's a more accomplished, more epic scale kind of film, I think, than previously. There's a lot of construction of narrative stuff happening in the opening, where we're getting shots of bills and drug bottles or whatever in the car, news on the radio, lots of quick, very succinct bits of exposition to tell us who the main character is that we're in the car with, and what is the situation that she's in, which is she's sort of pursuing this sky creature, as I think it's termed in the opening text. And then the action kicks off, and it is handheld. It's kind of got, well, is it handheld? It's kind of got that, is that kind of handheld, what's the term? It's gone from my head.
It's Steadicam. So it's not shaky.
Yeah. But it's not, exactly. It's moving, but it's not shaky. You can see what's going on. And it's fluid. It's like Upgrade or something.
Yeah. What it reminded me of, Maranto, the film that Gareth Evans did before.
Yeah, okay.
So he had, he'd built a particular rig, sort of camera rig for that, so the guy could wear it. Kind of felt like that. The fight scenes and that, the way the camera is in the middle of it, but sort of, getting out of the way and all the rest of it. And then, there's a sort of this trope now, isn't there? So when somebody gets hit really hard and the camera sort of follows them down as if the camera's been hit as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's a couple of examples of that in there. I just thought, it was really good sort of mixture of martial arts and gunplay going on. And, I didn't pick up, we talked just before we kicked off the review. You gave me a synopsis, which sounded like nothing like what we just watched, but the little clues that you mentioned there about the sort of, the drugs and everything in the car, or rather her medication, and that sort of suddenly it puts like her motivation into perspective, which is kind of interesting. The other guys in the other sort of bounty hunters, whatever they were just a bunch of assholes basically, at least sort of the main guy was. The fact that he just sort of turns around and goes, as soon as he says, we got time for a bit of fun, it's like, you're the assholes in this story. you're not the guys we're rooting for, that's for sure.
No, well, we've got to have some antagonists, and also the lead character, the actress and whatever. Yeah. I think her name's Fiona Ho, in real life, the actress's name. She's not anyone you really, she looks quite vulnerable and small and delicate or whatever. And then when it kicks off, you realise she's anything but. And you don't know we don't know what her backstory is or anything like that. But she's, she can handle herself really well. And goes up against these quite formidable forces to, all the while being, very, very unwell in herself. And it just works really well. It's just got that nice, it's a good action short, which I enjoy, but there's that bit more, there's that the sort of surprising visual effects revelation kind of later in the story. Mm-hmm. And, there's a question mark about, decisions that might be made or might not be made. And, I just think it's a very satisfying film.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve, got anything to add?
I agree with you, really. It was one of the most enjoyable shorts I've seen for a while, to be fair. Like you said, you've got that little bit of world building, with the drugs and everything like that. But also, it's got like an ethereal quality, especially with the ending. Mm. I thought the effects on the end were really good. And, they're all chasing this, is it $20 million bounty that's been put on it? Or,
that's right.
Whatever. And, it just worked really well. I mean, like you say, you could actually, for once, it kind of reminded me of John Wick in a way, where once you actually see the action and what's going on, it's not cut. It was fluid, it flowed, and you could tell what was happening for once. And then you get that ending, which just gives it more of a peaceful tone, if you know what I mean. It just gives it. It kind of reminded me of. Have you seen the shit, what's it called? Love, Death and Robots, the new ones that have come out.
Not the new ones. I've seen the like the first couple, I think.
Second episode of that. It kind of reminded me of that.
Right.
Where again, they go onto like an ice lake trying to find some creatures that are like that, and it kind of reminded me of that in a way. But yeah, no, really good, really good.
Cool. Rich, you want to talk about a couple of their other shorts just briefly?
So the couple of other films that I'd seen from the same director, from the, you know, from the same stable, as it were, and I think even featuring the same actress in smaller roles in those other ones. I'm not sure. She might have been the lead. But they're very different in tone, but you can definitely see the same director. I mean, the act, they're both very action-heavy shorts, these particular ones. The director has done other stuff, but these ones are very action-heavy. But they're also very very comical. You know, they're sort of extreme black comedy kind of exercises, rather, whereas this is a very kind of... This one's very serious. So I think there's a... I like that, but the other two, which I'm going to name, the Instagore and Dognap. Instagore is 8 minutes, and Dognap is 3 minutes. I love those movies. I think they're, I mean, for me, they're better than the Eighth One. I enjoyed them more. I do like that dark humor and that's in them.
Yeah. So I didn't get to finish Instagore before we start recording, but I love the concept of it. You know, this sort of weird. So Instagram account called Instagore, where you can upload your kills and beatings and stuff. But the one I did enjoy was Dognap, which the lead actress in that one, I believe, was the female bounty hunter in Eighth Wonder.
Yeah.
And
the one I didn't like.
The punchline is a bit... is dark.
But
I love the punchline. It's great.
The fights aren't as polished as they are in Eighth Wonder, but at the same time, you know, they are taking risks. You're watching it and you're thinking, if any of those, you know, they're not missing by much with those hammers and stuff. You know, they're ducking underneath these sort of wild swings, but they're selling it so well. You know, it's a bit of a wonder they haven't had a bit of an accident. I'm sure it's all fake props and everything, but even so, you know, they sell it very well. That's for sure. And I'm watching it, I'm thinking, Jesus, you know, that looks grim. You know, that was, again, you know, Gareth Evans' Raid 2 with the Hammer Girl sort of comes to mind. But, it was good. The punchline, I can see where you're coming from. I thought it was a bit too much as well.
But that's so if you see Instagore, I know you say you didn't get to the end, but that is it. They're very, I mean, both those films are very similar in tone and what they're doing. They're two peas in a pod, basically, compared to, say, Eighth Wonder is something completely different. But Steve, did you get to the end of Instagore?
Yeah, again, there's one bit that I weren't impressed with, but most of it, yeah, it was quite funny.
Was it the baby bit?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Yeah, it does go, so they do go a bit far on some of it. But yeah, again, I like Instagore. You know, it sets it up, it introduces this hitman character or hit girl character, hit woman, she's trying to collect on a job, and it's just really badly paid. And so then she gets served this ad that says, "Oh, download the app, take a really like grotesque picture or something, and you know, the more interest it gets, the more money you get or something from it." And so therefore she just sort of runs with that and finds it a better payday. It's a twist on the whole Uber and all that sort of thing of social media and that, and it almost becomes of the reason that she's doing it goes out the window because she just enjoys the social media kind of experience of it. It's very satirical. I think it's a very good piece of work. That's from 2017. Dognap's from 2016. Again, both on YouTube on the JKK Films channel.
Yeah, and I think we can, you know, you can see that sort of through line of progression.
Yes, you can, definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
You get more and more polished as they sort of go on. Yeah, so again, we don't score the shorts on this show, but we do recommend them, and we will put the links into the footnotes, so please check these out. They're a lot of fun, and yeah, great quality, good stuff. And don't forget to check out the DTV Digest Short Shots podcast, where me and Rich take a look exclusively at a bunch of shorts each time, so check that out as well. Our DTV throwback this week is Blunt Force Trauma. John is a professional duelist working the underground circuits of Colombia, hoping to gain the attention of the infamous Zorringa. On his travels, he hooks up with Colt, another gunslinger who is looking for the man who killed her brother. I've made no secret about this, guys. This is one of my favorite films. Hopefully you guys can see why. Let's start with Rich.
Yeah, I can see. Oh, sorry. I can see why you like it. It is very good. I enjoyed it a lot. The Ryan Kwanten, who I'm not a massive fan of, he's fine. He's good in this. But for me, the sort of standout is Frida Pinto. She's, you know, it's not the kind of film you would expect. If she's well known for, you know, she got a big break in Slumdog Millionaire or something. This film is quite an unusual, sort of a risky role for her. You know, it's a very different kind of thing. It's, you know, it's the theme of the movie is gunfighting, you know, it's kind of got a Western sort of element to it. It's got familiar elements to a genre film, but it's not a particularly marketable one, which I guess is probably why a lot of people haven't heard of it. I think it was a direct, you know, well, it was a DTV release. It's, you know, it's got that title, Blunt Force Trauma. It's got Mickey Rourke in there, and it just sort of feels a bit of an unusual mix, but that's what makes it unique. It's kind of I like that it's doing what we were saying about earlier in the show. You know, a lot of the films that we've talked about this week are very familiar genres, and, you know, use all the familiar conventions, and the, you know, they go exactly where you expect them to do. This one kind of does that as well, but it twists things. You know, it takes it in a different direction. So we've all seen, you know, the punch fight in movies and everything, of, you know, the underground fights where somebody, you know, loads of people are standing around with money, and there's two people, they got kit, and, you know, death ring matches and all that sort of stuff. Doing it with, you know, dueling, you know, shooting, you know, duels, you know, pistol duels, you know, guys shooting at each other, or, you know, men and women shooting each other, it's not something I recall ever seeing before. So that alone, you know, that makes it stand out. That all those scenes are executed brilliantly. The way the plot unfolds and that is really interesting. We've got the conventional guy who's trying to get his shot at the champion, you know, plot line. We've also got the revenge, you know, Frida Pinto's character, she's out for revenge for her brother getting killed, which again is kind of, if you know, it would be exactly the same in a martial arts film or something, but it's just got that different dimension. And then they do interesting things with the Frida Pinto's characters. She gets no resolutions or satisfactions anyway, you know, so her revenge plot is essentially cut short through developments in the story. And then it turns into, it's quite a romantic film. It's a story of a romance between these two characters. And, you know, it follows a very traditional romance plot line, you know, with all the falling out and getting back together and whatnot. But things do not work out again in a sort of a conventional way that you would expect. Ultimately getting to a point where the main character has to make a decision on what he really wants, and, you know, we're left contemplating, you know, why did that happen, you know, why did he end up in that situation. Before I say any more, because I want to talk about Mickey Rourke and stuff, let's throw it over to Steve.
Yeah, Steve, what do you reckon?
I really enjoyed this, actually. I know you've been going on about it for a bit, Mike, and I was going to wind you up and say it was shit, and then, you know, but you can't. I really did enjoy it. I think, like I was saying, I watched it in two parts, and I watched about half an hour, and it was just the fact that it was something that you've not seen before. You know, like Blood and Bone and stuff like that. It's, you know, the underground fighting. But I think the fact that it was dueling and it just put a new spin on it for me. I was like, I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah. Before, so then, just to sort of, you know, just to not embellish, but to explain a little bit with the dueling thing. So what we have is two people wearing bulletproof vests, and the idea is that they have to stand within a small circle, and the idea is to knock them out of the circle by shooting them. You know, it's not necessarily to kill them, just to get them out of the circle, and then they've got a count of 10 to get back in the circle or to give up. But yeah, as you say, it's not something we've seen before.
No, when I was talking about, if I can just interject, Sean Malloy from the from I Must Break This podcast was mentioning it, and he was saying how there's another film which I had heard of but I hadn't seen called 13, which featured people like Jason Statham, which was set in the world of Russian Roulette, which also featured Mickey Rourke, but it was a very different kind of film to this. But it's what. That film, although it's about shooting, it is still in that same sort of vein as many of these underground films, which is they're doing it for the entertainment of the wealthy. And it's usually rich people betting on these things. What's interesting about this movie is it's very squalid.
Yeah, it's very grassroots.
You know?
Steve, what else you got?
I don't know. But then you've also got, you know, the bit where they're waiting to get the invite to Mickey Rourke's or whatever, and, you know, trying to work his way up. And it doesn't go the way you think it's going to all the time. Like you say, you know, they fall out, break up, make up again, and then fall out, and then that's it. You know, she doesn't really come back into the film at all. And then it just has that nice little... Again, it's quite spiritual, you know, Mickey Rourke, as he is, you know, with his birds, as usual. But there's one little bit that really made me laugh when he goes up to the bird and it bites Ryan Quanten, and he just gives it like this shit house grin, and he's like, I'm going to fuck you up. But I must admit, I do like him. I still remember him in Home and Away years ago, but then he kind of like resurfaced in True Blood.
That's right.
And I thought he was great in that. I didn't finish it all, but first four seasons I thought were great, and I thought he was really good in it. But I've not really seen much since, and I thought he nailed it in this. I thought he was really good, and Freda Pinto as well.
Yeah,
it's basically two-handed between them two, really. Even Mickey Rourke's only in it for what, 5 minutes at the end, if that. But no, it was really good. Just something different, and that's what I liked about it.
Yeah. Rich, you want to mention Mr. Rourke?
Yeah, so Mickey Rourke obviously is prominent on the poster, and you're kind of waiting for him to turn up. He doesn't turn up until the 80-minute mark. That's the first time you see him. And for me, that was a weak part of the movie. It does change the dynamic. It changes the tone of the film. We kind of stop, and it's an indulgent Mickey Rourke performance where he gets to sort of wax lyrical, and you know, he's playing with the bird, and I felt the film kind of loses focus a bit at that point. And then when it comes to the combination, the final scene, you know, between those two, I wasn't entirely sure what was happening there, because there's no stakes, you know, there's nobody watching. It's literally just between these two gunfighters. And maybe that's the point. It's just ultimately it's not about the money. It's about trying to prove who's the better fighter or something. I'm not sure. But I did, upon reflection, when I was watching it later, I was thinking there's something very much like The Wrestler about the end of this movie. It's just, instead of being about Mickey Rourke's character, it's about the other guy. But there's definitely some echoes of The Wrestler and the way and the end of that film in this film, you know, in terms of also the relationship between Quanten and Pinto's character, and obviously Rourke and Tomei and The Wrestler. You know, the choices that that the men make and this mass and sort of very masculine dominated world that they're in, although Frida Pinto, you know, is definitely sort of holding her own. She's one of the good, she's very strong gunfight, duelist in herself, but it's a very masculine world. Now we were saying it's set in Colombia, but also I think there's an otherworldliness about it. It's like you don't really know where it is. It could be anywhere, I was thinking about things like AWOL, where we've got, again, it's kind of this built up world where there's, in that film, Jean-Claude Van Damme's character, he meets like the woman who's kind of operating it all. Yeah. She's kind of it's a classy woman who's sort of setting it all up. And there's an echo there.
Yeah,
but, the world that she's operating in is, she ends up being very, well, quite similar in a lot of ways, but there's no glamour to any of this. It's all very down and dirty, which I like. It gives it a very unique sort of feel.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, it manages to it does two things with the jewels. I mean, for one thing, it doesn't overly explain what's happening. The way it opens, and you're just left to sort of put the pieces together as to what the actual rules are and everything, what's going on. But also, each duel happens in a very different sort of locale. So one's at that sort of train yard, one's in that sort of farmyard sort of thing.
There was the one that where they're in the, they have to go in the pit, the engineer's pit, and it's really constrictive environment, that you can't stretch your arms out or anything. They've really got to keep their hands close. Mm-hmm. And the idea is they've got to do this quick draw, and, that's really going to impact your move. So they put them in, like you say, these very sort of particular environments, and the very, the opponents, it's not all, there's one scene where they make a point of saying, it's not just about speed, it's about resilience. And you're about to go up against somebody who is really very resilient.
It's another element.
I'm just going to say, I like the bit with the police as well.
Yeah.
That bit.
Wankers.
Yeah. Because obviously, because they obviously know what the crack is and they know what's going on.
Yeah.
And they're aware of it. And that bit, I really enjoyed that bit, because you just give it that little bit of edge and you're like, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
That bit of tension in there as well.
There's another good scene with the when he goes to the doctor after he gets when he gets shot the first time, and he goes to the doctor. The doctor explains the whole thing about what blunt force trauma is and what the risks are. You're wearing a vest, but it's not going to protect you in the long run. Sort of thing. If you keep getting shot, basically, you might end up sort of splintering a bone or something, and that could puncture a lung and all this. So the stakes are pretty high, if not immediately lethal. The fact that Frida Pinto's Colt's brother died of injuries, etc. So there are sort of quite high stakes involved, but just not immediately lethal, shall we say, until we get to that brilliant final, where they both sort of chuck the vest away and strip off, which is quite funny. Frida Pinto, I loved Frida Pinto in this, absolutely. But the moment that absolutely kills me, her final words to him before she leaves is she just says, "Stupid, stupid man," and then as he's about to duel, that's what he hears in his head, sort of "stupid, stupid man," and he can see it in his eyes. It's like, oh shit, I've made a mistake. He's about to sort of throw down with Mickey Rourke, for keeps, and suddenly in his head it's like, I made a mistake, oh no. I thought it was an absolutely brilliant moment. And then the end, it has a very enigmatic ending. It deliberately teases you to thinking you don't know who's survived. But then during the credits, there's a very sort of, a slow-mo out of focus shot. And you just have to focus on the jeans, the color of the jeans, because it was quite distinctive. So you can figure out who actually won that duel. But yeah, no, I've said it before, I love this film. I did watch 13, actually, this afternoon as well, which has got a cracking cast. I mean, Ray Winston, Jason Statham, 50 Cent, for some reason, and Mickey Rourke, all in there.
Michael Shannon's in there as
Michael,
well.
Michael Shannon doing the compare bit. See, that was one of the main differences as well, is that Michael Shannon's there sort of yelling out the instructions to everyone. You know, so you know exactly what's going on. Whereas in the Blunt Force Trauma, it's like, no, you figure it out. It will give you the visual clues. But I enjoyed 13 for the most part. It is a much more sort of nihilistic film than Blunt Force Trauma.
But, it's a very different sort of, completely different time because and style of film, because like I said, one, it's set in that sort of rich man's world kind of version of these kind of things, but also it's one of those films that takes an outsider and puts them in rather than being the experienced fighter following him. And for me, I mean, Sam Riley's that character is playing the lead in that room. It felt that movie for me, just because that went direct to video as well, felt, although it has this epic cast, did feel like cheap and a bit shabby. I've only watched half an hour or so of it, but then Mickey Rourke's in there. He turns up. He's playing one of the guys. I think he's number 17.
Yeah.
And they do like these. They do this in the bit that I've seen so far. So they introduce him and he's around, and then they do a character scene with like a little flashback.
Yeah.
For just sort of introducing him, and it was almost like, I don't know why, a bit like when we were talking about Nightwalk earlier, and that, you know, you get these asides and stuff, and it's like not really sure why they're doing too much of that. I mean, that might, you know, it might all come together a bit more when I watch the rest of the movie. But going back to, you know, Mickey Rourke, and, you know, you look at him in that film.
Yeah.
He's wearing he's got a beard and stuff in that, which I think suits him better, and you know, helps cover up some of the surgical interventions and whatnot. But he's doing his typical Rourke thing of the, you know, the sort of cowboy hat kind of approach. I mean, in Blunt Force Trauma, he literally is wearing his usual cowboy boots.
Those fucking boots, they just look ridiculous.
Didn't he wear the same like in Double Team or something? I think he was wearing high top trainers or something in that. But he loves wearing jeans, and he loves just having his chest exposed, doesn't he? It's just always.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Wasn't he wearing Spurs in Double Team?
I'm sure he was.
Yeah, he might have been as well. I mean, he wore a couple of, a few different outfits. I think at some point he was wearing cowboy boots. I'm pretty sure he was. And, the way he looks so different in all these different, you know, we've covered Point Blank with him as well, which was probably him at his biggest when he's big in this. He looks for Blunt Force Trauma, to me, he looked quite similar shape to what he was in Take.
Yeah.
Take Back. He was kind of similar. We end up in a very similar situation, actually. The ending of Take Back and the ending of Blunt Force Trauma are actually not that different. They're actually very similar scenes.
True. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we don't score the DTV throwbacks, I don't believe. If memory serves.
Nope.
No. But we highly recommend it. This is available on Amazon Prime. You've heard us. Well, I'm always gushing over this. These guys are on board. Please check it out. I think it's an overlooked gem, that's for sure. Thank you for listening. Thank you for Steve and Rich for joining me this evening.
No problem. Always a pleasure.
As usual. Don't forget to check out our Facebook and DTV pages. Don't forget to check out our Twitter and Facebook pages at the DTV Digest. Also check out our sister show, the Short Shots, and its own Twitter page. Other than that, thank you for listening and tune in again next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.